open it up and take questions from the floor. And we'll take a cluster and see how time goes on, and then have responses from the table. Humaira.
First of all, thank you very much for your very interesting presentations, and I think overall, generally, first of all, you have to go with most of it. I'm very critical, as you know, but I think I can go. But there are some commissions, I think, I felt overall. You sort of started the feel I've got, is that you start from the point of without recognising that there was a history before the attempts at positive engagement started, that there was already a disengagement. And I certainly know in our organisation it's something that we sort of raised into the mid-80s to say that there's been this anti-racist policies and multiculturalism failed to take on board the fact that there was such a thing as a faith identity, and the Muslim community in particular were being excluded from it. And the other thing is the recognition that the faith issue has come about, as whether people like it or not, because everybody likes it, is that the faith issue has come about as a consequence of secular society not being able to know how to deal with the Muslim community. So in a sense, I always say it's our brothers being put on the line, really, to tackle this dilemma of secular society. How does it integrate faith, which is where some aspects of secularism is not about faith. And I think I also want to say something about you made this differentiation between the Labour Party's approach and the Conservative Party's approach. I would argue that actually their approach is exactly the same. The difference is the Labour Party put the church in the centre, the Conservatives have put the church in the centre, whereas the Labour Party, in fact, who, as has been said, were the stuck their neck out and put faith on the map, they put it on the peripheral, although they made it central, but not at the center of their policy, but they made it an important part of it. But both put the Church of England as the caretakers of faith communities. So in that sense, that they have both done that. While I personally don't have any problems with that necessarily, but then what that does is it makes us into a religion only, and doesn't enable us to be citizens. You know, I don't mind being a religion, I don't mind being anything, but in a sense, from public policy, it puts us in a different box, and it fails to address the failure of successive governments in addressing the issue of faith minorities and Muslim communities in the mainstream. And what you don't seem to, while you focused on political participation, most Muslim organisations, I would argue, haven't really engaged in the processes of how we make ourselves citizens. It might be in the representation game, but we make ourselves citizens by engaging at local levels, in local democracy, in local service delivery, and all of that. If you're being excluded from local democracy and local service delivery, that's where the problem starts, and that's where you have excluded minorities, in this case Muslim communities, who are going to this spiral of socio-economic decline, basically. So the radicalization, which often people don't focus on, which has emerged from the Muslim community, has become as a reaction to a sort of feeling of exclusion and a feeling that you have a voice. So those things. And I think the things that we have to remember for the faith community, we operate, part of what we want is our practice. For example, if it's about prayer facility, wearing dress, that's about practice. That's not about public. Okay, some of it's public policy, but it's not about practice. It's not about our lives we live. And there's also about our religion, what we see ourselves as a religion overall. But it's our services that we get and we pay for as citizens, as of this society, that we have to question that. Are government responsible for its failure of public policy? Why haven't they taken a strong stance on Islamophobia and the way that they've taken on prevent and dealing with radicalization within the Muslim community? They haven't taken a strong stand on other things. And I'll just say, since my ex-boss is here, John Eversley, that when in the late 80s, we did actually start shaping an equal opportunities policy which took on board faith communities as part of the integrated process. But the Liberal Democrats, when they came in, they got rid of us, our home unit, and we never really got back there. I'm not sure if we're back there in any significant way yet at a local level with local authorities who understand what faith communities is at that level. Because I meet them constantly and they don't know.
Okay, thank you. That was a very full statement. I've got Linda Woodhead, Jonathan Chaffin, and Malik Malik on the list, and someone at the back as well. Good. Let's have you in that order, and perhaps you could just introduce yourself at the start for people who don't know you, Linda. Thank you. Jonathan?
Jonathan Taylor, Cambridge. Two quick questions. First, the presentation emphasized very much that the number of Muslim political actors are keen not to emphasize the distinctiveness, the specialness of the Muslim participation. But are there not any Muslim groups out there saying, actually, we do have something substantive and distinctive to offer in society? Distinctive Muslim leading on the public good, for example, drawing in a battle of interest and its implications for economic policy. So is there pressure, in other words, for Muslim groups to play down precisely the unique thing that they're meeting, so they have to offer to the public debate? And so that's the first question. And secondly, it's a question about British values. I was struck by the reference to coalition's desire to tighten the understanding of British values. A while ago, I read about a dozen public reports since 2000 on this theme, all of them delivering in high rhetoric the need for clearer statements of national shared values, and all of them proving incredibly disappointing when it came to delivering exactly what they were. So, specific question, this prevent form, which I was intrigued to hear about, I'd love to see that form, does that get us any further? Or are we it's simply another reiteration of generic, fairly vacuous values that pretty much everybody can agree with, and therefore which don't actually serve the intended political purpose, which I think is a suspect purpose, to cast suspicion on certain minorities.
Thank you. Well, here.
Yes, thanks very much for both projects. I think it's really exciting that the results are coming out now. I just hope that the less intense focus on Muslims in some of the political debates means that you'll be able to have a more productive kind of impact of these projects. There's just two things. One was an observation to Therese about her sense about revenge, and just anecdotally, that's my sense as well, because actually I think it's had unintended consequences. And when I think about some of the kind of young Muslims who've been involved in projects, either involved in present or resisting prevent, I'm kind of reminded of my favourite quote from Foucault, which is, he talks about Subject of Power, he talks about the way in which political power by people who have a lot of power sometimes acts as a catalyst, has totally different consequences. So I think makes you and I be more optimistic about prevent. But the second point I wanted to make was about the Equality Act 2010 and link it with Mera's point. Because I think one of the great achievements of New Labour under the Equality Act was what we call a harmonised approach to public provision of the public sector. So although you accommodate key aspects of faith at the point of the provision of public services, such as schools or hospitals and or other forms of public goods, which as Mera said, we all pay for as citizens, you have accommodation at that point, but that accommodation is not about separatism, it's actually about mainstreaming those minorities into the provision of common public goods we all pay for as citizens. I actually think that one of the consequences of the coalition's approach to the big society, ironically, is that it will achieve exactly what David Cameron is afraid of in that Munich multiculturalism speech. So I think the big society is much more likely to be the centrifugal forces that will actually cause fragmentation for us as citizens in our access to key public services. So that's really my expert observation. But once again, thanks for both projects.
Okay. Thank you. And you had a question, yeah?
Yeah.
Could you see the dikes?
Thank you very much. We don't have a lot of time left, so I'd like to give people from the table some time to respond, but I don't think you'll be able to respond to everything, so please be selective. We'll let the other project go first. So Therese, do you want to go first? 2 minutes.
Okay, right, that's tall order. Well, thank you very much for those comments. I think they were really, really helpful. So, yeah, obviously I'm under constraint in terms of being able to address all of them. But I should say, Mary, thank you very much for signalling, you know, the importance of the kind of prehistory to New Labour's approach to engagement with faith and Muslims. And I think that is really important. And there is a danger in this narrative in sort of looking at the continuities and changes between New Labour and the coalition that we lose sight of what happened, you know, prior to 1997. And I think that's a really important point for us in terms of the writing of our report, and particularly to have a think about, you know, what was happening prior to then and ways in which that's set, you know, the kind of models that got pursued under New Labour. And I think it is interesting to note the ways in which local models of engagement do or don't engage with Muslims and under what terms. And I think, you know, perhaps the sort of tenor of our research or the sort of dominant kind of finding is that there's a lot of local variation on this. So in some areas, I think, you know, there is a real dominance of faith and interfaith structures, which I guess, you know, carries with it the risk that you point to, which is that it's engagement as faith actors and not necessarily as citizens. But I think what's, you know, perhaps what's the interest of the project is that there's such a lot of variation, particularly at local level, in those models of engagement, which I hope we'll be able to tease out in a bit more detail. Turning in relation to Linda's question about the kinds of ways in which Muslim civil society groups or you know, the models of self-organisation. I mean, I think it's certainly true to suggest that, you know, from what people, actors have been saying to us, is that they do find some of the modes of state recognition and engagement very distorting of what they see as, you know, issues of representation, particularly in relation to the sort of diversity of Muslim communities, populations, particularly at local level. And I should also say that what we also come across is sometimes quite a sustained critique of the structure of political parties, as well as modes of local authority engagement with Muslim groups. So sometimes what we see is a kind of search, not necessarily for a move towards more individualised modes of engagement or consultation, but a seeking out of other kinds of modes of collective organisation that will enable, for instance, young Muslims to sort of come through at the local level and to achieve a kind of voice. So that, I mean, that's quite interesting. Now, some people we do see willing to do it within the, you know, the structures of the party, but also for many a desire to move outside of the party, the political party, or to move outside of sort of local bureaucratic systems of consultation and engagement. So one example of that, for instance, might be the move towards community organising, the sort of broad-based organising on the model of the kind of telco Citizens UK kind of model. Seeing that as a kind of basis on which perhaps, you know, younger Muslims can achieve organisation, you know, collective organisation, and a more satisfactory model of, you know, representation and voice. Sorry, I'm wheeling through these so quickly. In terms of the British Values form, we've got a copy of it. I guess we can, you know, share some of the aspects of that. But what I should say is I do think it's not a statement that I think is necessarily, you know, of British values, in the sense that a lot of it is the kinds of values that you might associate with liberal democratic kind of values. So I think it resonates, you know, with some of the kinds of remarks that you might get from Jotke about, you know, what does talk about national identity across Europe actually amount to? And quite often there is very little actual national content to a lot of that discussion. I think you can find that in, you know, some of the values that are included inside that form. Thank you very much for the comments about unintended consequences. I think, yeah, we should talk more about what happens there. And then just finally, just to say, just to respond to Christina's comments about the way that we portrayed conservative policies. First of all, I should say that what I think the kinds of comments that we're making about multiculturalism are to say that I suppose the lesson that we bring is that actually, if you look at implementation at the local level, our view would be that actually it's going to be quite hard to dislodge multiculturalism from a particular local context. So whether or not the coalition thinks it's time to move on from multiculturalism, at the local level, local actors are very wedded to values and practices of multiculturalism. So notwithstanding the kinds of remarks or, you know, the kinds of steer that comes from DCLG or from Cameron, the coalition, that I think local actors will remain committed to multiculturalist models of working and multiculturalist practices. And one of the observations that we make about the big society is that actually the levels of autonomy and freedom that it accords to local actors means perhaps there's an enlarging scope for those local actors to pursue multiculturalist kinds of objectives. And I also, you know, take your point that you know, there was, of course, a great deal of criticism about Prevent, and you know, it's the idea of it being failed and friendless, I think, probably resonates with a lot of people in this room. So the remarks that we make about Prevent are to say that, yes, you know, that narrative is out there. There are many problematic logics that were clearly evident in the Prevent programme as it was developed under New Labour. But to see the development of Prevent as an entirely negative kind of episode in states, you know, the history of states' engagement with Muslims, I think is to kind of miss the whole picture, and particularly to miss the significance of those local variations and the different ways in which local actors implemented Prevent. So that's the story that we're trying to tell, which is this is perhaps one of complexity and diversity about the way that Prevent got implemented. I'll leave it there.
Thank you. Do you want to add anything, Dan?
I'll just add extremely briefly, just so that we don't take any more time. On those comments from Christina as well, I hope that we portrayed near neighbors in as even-handed a way as possible, which is that it's something which some actors actually feel on the ground has been very good. Other actors are much more critical of it. But in terms of the coalition's perspective on it, it's a way to work through the Church of England, and there hasn't been any sort of response or answer in terms of other representative bodies or multi-faith from that perspective. The Church of England's actually taken quite a different perspective, I think, on the way the Near Neighbours is managed, and there's a lot more nuance to that picture, and I think it's important for us to say that it has been good in many respects.